Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my guest is Tidbits security editor, Rich Mogul. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I've been reading your stuff on Tidbits mostly for years now, and every time I read a security article from you, I am just blown away, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show. You are the VP of product at Disrupt Ops and an analyst and CEO at Securosis. With 2 decades of experience, you're an expert in information security, physical security, and risk management. You're also a regular contributor to Tidbits, Information Security Magazine, and Macworld, where I have seen you write as well.
So I have to admit, it's been a while since I've done some Macworld, though, so I might need to update that bio.
Yeah, Glenn Fleischman's doing some nice work on Mac details and security and Time Machine and the deep stuff that we like to dive into at Macworld. He's doing a good job there. I've had Glenn on the show. He's terrific. But I want to talk about you. So were you always interested in computers? Is that something that you started off very young with?
Yeah, I mean, I think I first started coding in third grade on Commodore PETs at school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh. So actually, I got sent to the principal's office because I was I would sit outside of the one classroom that had the 2 Commodore PETs in it at all hours. And they apparently, I don't know, I was cluttering the hallway or something.
That Commodore PET, was that basic like the Apple II?
It was quite a bit more basic than the Apple II, but yeah. basic programming for sure. People can go look them up online, and that's what I spent my first year or two learning to program on.
When I first saw the Commodore PET, I thought it was something right out of Star Trek, and I wanted one so desperately, but it turned out my technical interest that led me to the high-res color graphics on an Apple II, so I bought one of those instead. Yeah, those were cool machines. And that and the Trash 80, which everybody had, I guess.
Well, yeah, not us. We were a little lower on the income scale back then. But eventually, a friend of the family got us a Commodore 64, got me one. And things went from there. I got involved in BBSs and hacking and all of those things until, I realized, maybe some of this might be illegal. I probably shouldn't do it.
Well, what was your first computer that you owned?
It was that Commodore 64. So a friend of our family's actually got it for me at the time because he thought he would, be inspiring me to a future career in technology. And at the time, I wanted nothing of it. I was going to go be an astronaut or something. And he was right. I was wrong.
Did you major in computer science in college?
No, I had a major in history. And then I was working on a second degree in molecular biology. And eventually decided I need to get out of college after 8 years. So I finished a little short on the bio degree. But at that point, I was working full-time for the university in IT anyway.
Was this at CU, University of Colorado?
Yep, up in Boulder.
Yeah, it's a nice place. Our Jeff Gamet, managing editor, is up there. Yeah, awesome. So that happens to a lot of us. We get into science, and then as getting into science, we end up with computers, and then the computers become more and more luring and attractive, and then we find ourselves falling out of the science and into the computers, and it consumes our lives.
Yeah, it was, it was never my intention. I started off as, history. I was Navy ROTC, was going to go that route. Took a year off and became a paramedic, did a little work there, and then left the military before I went on active duty because I thought, I can go to med school. And the program I was in didn't have scholarships really for that, or didn't have many.
Oh, I was in the military too. What did you do?
Well, like I said, I wasn't. So I was in Navy ROTC. I was on scholarship, and then I left after getting my paramedic because I thought I was going to go to med school. And the ROTC, they only have like 5 or something, or at least at that time, scholarships to put people to med school because they want, unrestricted line officers. So I left assuming I was going to go back into the military, but then I realized after working in medicine for a year or two that, being a doctor kind of sucks. And that's when I fell into technology instead.
I was talking to a nurse a while back, and she was awesome. She was technical, and she was very attentive, and she was just amazing. And I said, "You're very good. You should be a doctor." She said, "No, no. Have you seen their hours? Have you seen their lives?"
That's what it was. The lifestyle. And even though I was in emergency, and that was the path I was headed because of my paramedic background, I realized that, I could do that, but I started having other opportunities that became more interesting.
Now, at some point, you fell into a Mac. How did that happen? The Mac world.
So I was basically, we can blame, if you know a gentleman by the name of Chris Pepper, for that. Chris is a good friend of mine from back in high school and early college days, and he's kind of does a lot of editing. But Chris will edit other people's work and send them an email whether or not he's been asked to do so. And Chris and I were friends, and he spent years trying to get me on a Mac. And of course, I was a Windows admin when I was doing some of my earlier technical work. And because of that, I, eventually when the Macs switched to the Intel Macs, so there's a couple of things that happened. First was I got my first iPod, and I loved the user experience. And I think it was a Gen 3. It was the one that had kind of more of the light up orange buttons, mm-hmm. Of the original, the hard drive based iPods. And I still have that.
Next, does the battery still work?
I haven't plugged it in a while. So if not, though, I know I could replace that out.
My wife had one like that. It lasted 10 years, and the battery finally died after 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, if it wasn't for the fact I can carry more songs on my watch, I might use it for something else. And so I had that, and I liked that experience. And then I got, I think it was one of the Airport Expresses or something along those lines. It was, I think it was an Airport Express. To do the, not the Flying Saucer, but the smaller one for music streaming and such.
Okay.
And that created an extender. And then that worked really well. And then the Intel Macs came out. And that's when I jumped all over it. It was a Mac Mini first. And I had this in parallel with my Windows computer I had to use for work. And I was at Gartner at that point. And I started realizing I was spending most of my time on the Mac Mini. Incredibly underpowered, didn't have everything I needed. It was just, I enjoyed that experience more. And so when the Intel Macs came on, that's when I switched completely in full violation of Gartner's policies and managed to hack my way through everything and get it all set up and accessed all the resources. And it was off to the races.
Was the Unix element of Mac appealing to you from a security standpoint? Because Unix is sort of a hacker's haven.
Yeah, it was a little bit of that. Part of it was when I got that first Mac Mini, I hadn't done much Unix work or really any. And I wanted to do more there and some, experimentation kinds of things. So it was less that it was more secure because I knew it wasn't necessarily more secure than the version of Windows I was on at that point. And that was, I think, Vista. So once you got past XP, Windows was not in bad shape in terms of inherent security.
XP was a disaster. It was Virusville.
Yeah, and still is. I mean, you can still find it running in places.
Yeah. I cringe every time I walk into a doctor's office and see them running Windows XP, although that I haven't had that experience in a long time, but it lasted longer than it should have.
Yeah, far longer even than Microsoft wanted it to they finally realized. They made certain bad decisions and they paid the cost of that to the point of where, the backstory is that the federal government basically went to Microsoft and said, we cannot buy Windows anymore until you fix this.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. And that was in 2000, 2001, which is when Microsoft came out with the Trustworthy Computing Initiative. And that was after a couple of waves of viruses. The U.S. federal government, if you don't know, is the largest IT buyer in the world. And they were serious because it had hit the point where they were, the security issues were making it unusable at the government scale.
We made a big fuss out of that when I was working for Apple about that time. And it was basically Mac OS X something like Panther or Jaguar pitted against XP. I kept telling my customers that, you know, Windows XP had some serious, serious problems. And they said, well, the only reason the Mac is more secure is because it's obscure, security through obscurity. And I kept trying to tell them, no, 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 you can't think that way.
Well, no, but they were right. OS X at that point, and, you know, was not more inherently secure than Windows.
That was before things like ASLR and all sorts of cool stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And for years after that, after the Vista release, OS X was less secure, inherently secure. But what I used to do, and this is what I think got me on the radar of the Mac community, was as I talked about safety versus security. And you were safer on OS X. You were more inherently secure on Windows.
Tell me about that. Fill in blanks on that. What does it mean to be safer but less secure?
So if I live in a rural area with very low crime rates, I can leave my house unlocked and not have an alarm system and not worry about cameras. And I am less likely to suffer a criminal incident. If I live where I do now in, you know, the heart of Phoenix or even my place in Boulder, I am at higher risk of a security incident, even if I have more security systems. So look, I'm here in Phoenix, and I'm a security expert, and I got to design the system from my house when it was built. So it's all hardwired and not aftermarket. And I've got a great one, but I am still more likely to suffer a crime here than in plenty of other areas of the country.
Okay. So how does, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but how does Windows 10 these days compare to Mac OS High Sierra?
You know, it's going back and forth a little bit. I think Windows 10 is still probably potentially more inherently secure. It is not as secure as iOS. iOS is the safest and most secure consumer platform in history. And I feel pretty unequivocal about saying that. And it's now hitting the point where those comparisons almost don't matter anymore. Windows is secure enough and OS X is secure enough, the current versions. Now, Apple has made some mistakes recently.
Root access. Was that December of 17?
Oh, my God.
Do you have any insights into how that can happen?
Yeah, I mean, just because I've worked on big software projects from a security perspective, and they didn't test for it, and it was a regression, and some of these things can be difficult to test for. And, you know, I don't know all the ins and outs of their internal security testing process and who's running it now. I know they care, and they didn't care, for the record, much when I first started covering Apple, and, you know, probably around that.
Was it overconfidence because it was Unix?
Those errors were not overconfidence. I mean, that's just a mistake. Like, somebody put a regression in, somehow it got through, it wasn't checked. And if you thought about the process of what you had to click through to recreate that error, you know, some of those things, like some of the passcode screen bypasses, I mean, they can be really hard to find depending on the nature of the testing you're doing. And even if you're doing something like fuzz testing, which is a common technique to find a bunch of these kinds of things, doesn't help with user interface related issues. It should have been picked up, very likely. And it's just a matter of, you know, what internal test failed to catch that. But they've got that, or the one that I'm reading now, that it looks like passwords for encrypted volumes may be stored in logs. I don't really know how that happened. I haven't had time to investigate it and other ones. But what I can say is that Apple has, you know, very significantly improved their process around this stuff in the, I don't know, 10 to 12 years or whatever it's been that I've been writing about them publicly.
Okay, I want to talk to you more about some of the technical aspects of Macs and security in part two. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you about what you did at Gartner. You were involved in security work at Gartner. Was that security analysis or was that internal security?
That was security analysis. So the weird path was, because the paramedic, I went back to school, got a part-time job as a PC tech, and within about 3 years had my own department at the university doing software development for the College of Business. One of the professors I worked with recruited me to join a consulting startup of his, covering emerging technologies and such, and he had contracted me out on a writing project that was security related because he knew I kind of had a background and an interest in it. Nothing formal at that time. So I went and ended up joining his company and they got acquired by Gartner. And within a year, I was on the analyst team on the security side. So I covered a variety of technologies, predominantly data security oriented. So people had heard about, you know, DLP and encryption, enterprise encryption and such. And then I also covered a lot of kind of newer issues and emerging technologies things, just because I had an affinity for figuring those things out.
Okay.
So I was there for about 7 years, and I co-chaired the Gartner Security Conference. And you know, I don't have bad things to say. Gartner's good for what it does, and it was a great place for me to start. And it, you know, it helped me end up on the phone with Phil Schiller at one point, although that call didn't go well.
Well, I want to hear more about your current work at Disrupt Ops and being CEO of Securiosis. But first, we have to take a short break, folks. I'm talking to Rich Mogul, security editor at Tidbits. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back on Fetting with Rich Mogul. So you told me that you are the VP of product at Disrupt Ops, a company I have not heard of, and CEO at Securiosis. Tell me about both of those companies in turn and what you do and what products they do.
Yeah, so I'll start with Securiosis because that's where I started. So after 7 years at Gartner, I left and founded Securiosis. So that was about 10-ish years ago. And it was we're a research and analysis firm. So I'm an industry analyst, which means for the security world, the kind of where I started was I wanted to do research to help people get their jobs done better and faster, security people. So we do research on a variety of security issues, and my job is to be kind of an expert on, you know, the parts of security that I cover. So I'm very good, I think, at, you know, at the broad level, but any security person knows you have to dig in on a couple of areas to, you know, where you can be kind of more of the expert on it. For me, that was on data security, application security, but it has evolved over time to be cloud security. So these days I'm focused pretty exclusively on cloud and do a lot of research on cloud security. I write research reports. I, you know, run around at conferences speaking, and then I do a lot of advisory work both with security vendors. So, you know, kind of any major security vendor you've heard of, I've probably worked with at various points, helping them on their product and market strategy, and then large organizations, helping them on their security strategy. These days, I'm almost more like a regular old consultant, though, because I do a lot of cloud security assessments and architecture work and helping people design their, you know, security cloud into their cloud applications. Well, based on a lot of that research led to Disrupt Ops. And that's actually a separate company. And we recently got funding for it. And that's a cloud security and operations automation platform, which is really new. We're going to be putting customers in, the first customers in about 4 to 6 weeks, it looks like. And so that's really exciting. And now I'm working two jobs and I'm hoping to get back down to one at some point.
Does your work there involve coordination, cooperation with the major cloud servers, Amazon, AWS, and Microsoft, or is this separate from that?
So we run the, so first of all, the clients I advise, I work with them on their cloud projects when they have things deployed in the three major providers.
Okay.
And my typical recommendation is only use those three. So that's Amazon, Microsoft, and Google. I don't really recommend any of the other ones that are out there.
So there's certain practices and options and procedures that they can engage in or not engage in that makes their work with these major server cloud servers more secure.
Is that how it works? Exactly. Yeah. So Amazon has, you know, hundreds of different security features, maybe thousands and options. And that depends on which Amazon products you're using. Cause you know, it's not just the cloud. You have storage services and compute services and function as a service and machine learning and databases. So it's how do you mix and match all of those plus the security products that the cloud providers have, encryption services, vulnerability assessment and others. So how do you use all of those properly?
Okay, got it. Okay, cool. Well, we're not going to have too much more time left, so I have a long list of questions I wanted to ask you from a Mac user perspective or an Apple customer perspective. So what do you say? Let's just dig in.
Yeah, works for me.
What's the most important thing that Mac and iPhone users should know about the security of their products? Is it possible to sort of provide some overall guidance about how to handle your machines that you think are wise practices?
Absolutely. Now, of course, it's different. So iOS is extremely secure. You know, as I mentioned, I think it's the most secure consumer computing platform that's available right now. And follow along with the defaults that Apple guides you towards. And what do I mean by that? Make sure you've got a good passcode. Make sure you're good around your Apple ID account, your iCloud account, and that you've got the multi-factor authentication set up.
Right.
And, you know, the rest kind of takes care of itself for the most part. I do recommend being good about backups as well. I like local encrypted backups because that actually stores more information and makes restoring faster and easier. But
good advice.
And then just don't enable things that are obviously, you know, not good.
What do you think of iCloud Keychain? Do you think it's wise or not wise to put your keychain that has all your important passwords in Apple's hands, even though it's encrypted in the cloud?
You know, if you understand how that works, it's actually a pretty good architecture. So there's two pieces of that. One is iCloud Keychain Sync. And Apple, if you have that turned on, they don't keep a copy of your keychain. Items are individually encrypted, passed through iCloud, and then sent and synchronized across all the devices.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other is the backup. And there's options for iCloud keychain backup, where if you set your own security code that's separate from like your passcode, that is extremely well encrypted using top-of-the-line, what we call HSMs, hardware security modules. And Apple has published this, and they have very strong processes internally around how they manage the keys to that. So for a full keychain backup, I think that, you know, that's fine. I use it myself. Just I don't use the default option. I kind of go the next level up by setting a separate passcode for it.
Okay.
A separate recovery key.
Let me ask you about encrypted DMGs. Apple started off with the first encrypted DMGs as 128 AES. Then not too long afterwards, they jumped to 256-bit, but it's been 256-bit AES for maybe a decade now or so. Is that really enough anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a few million years, we might need to revisit that, or possibly as we approach the heat death of the universe. Otherwise, it's fine.
It's fine. Okay.
It's more than fine. AES 256 is the standard that is not going to be crackable by brute force mechanisms unless... You know, there's some, I mean, it isn't the protocol itself, as long as it's properly implemented from an encryption standpoint, even AES 128 is probably good enough. We have no indications in the cryptographic community that either of those are anywhere near at risk. Now, when quantum computing hits, maybe something will change. But for now, those are, you have nothing to worry about using that.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
At the Mac Observer, we've written a lot about how the FBI and other law enforcement agencies would like to have a backdoor into just any old iPhone so that they can, with or without a warrant that's to be determined, you know, hack in to somebody's phone through a backdoor on the internet. And we're told by all the experts that it's impossible to create a backdoor that's controlled and managed properly only by law enforcement. As soon as you create a possibility of a backdoor. There's some bad guy will figure out a way to get in. Is that correct? And can you give me some color on why it's not possible to have a backdoor that works?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And so here's the reasons why. Because the backdoor, so there's a couple of options there that they could actually use, and various distributed key options. So you can have versions of encryption where like three people each have part of a key and you need all three of those to come together. Mm-hmm. And they can be different organizations. Even in those situations, we believe that it is incredibly dangerous move. And then it also has large international social impacts. So let's talk about the technology piece of it first. There is those things, that means putting in a key that is not changed, that those organizations can use to gain access to a device. What happens when they lose that key or if somebody abuses that key? Nothing like that can be kept secret for long.
Because, it's one key for 100 million iPhones, or is it a different key for every phone?
Yeah, I mean, either you need a database with all the keys, and then somebody else steal that. Oh. I mean, the NSA has already lost its most sacred hacking tools, and that have been repurposed and published on the internet and then repurposed for malware.
Was that a hack that came in from the outside, or was that an internal leak?
It was a combination of both, is our understanding right now. So, and there's just no way. And if you think about the ability to get onto a phone, it's one thing if it's only the FBI and maybe only one small team at the FBI. But we know that's not going to happen because states' attorney generals have already said they want access to our devices as well to prosecute drug trafficking, to prosecute murderers, all the local crimes that occur. And they are going to ask for that access as well, which means all of a sudden, you know, either you need, you know, 1,000 agents who are able to go into the devices, or all these law enforcement agencies are able to get in themselves without outside of the federal government. I mean, it's a mess from a systems standpoint. It's just not possible that could be taken, could be done in secret. And there's no way to build a system like that that doesn't have some kind of an opening that a bad guy can go after as well. So there's no way to put in a back door without reducing the security of the platform.
You know, General Michael Hayden has told that story publicly. He was former director of CIA and NSA and has warned that that is a dangerous thing to do. Why is it that law enforcement doesn't understand or isn't listening technically to the actual technical facts here and the risk to national security? Why do they keep pushing, in your perspective? Well,
so there's a couple of reasons for this, and it depends on who you're talking with. On one side, it's you know, it's the Harry Potter effect. It's that technology is wizardry, and hackers are and tech professionals are wizards, good or bad, white hats and black hats, and can do anything. And because of that, that means any problem can be solved. And no, they can't. I mean, there are some things that are just, you know, you can't break the speed of light. And there's, but it's hard for people to understand that. Well, there's got to be a way. Let's put the best minds on it. And then there are some scientists that come out with models that, well, yeah, if you use, you know, some of these split key models and everything else, but they don't take, they don't look at that in the context of the world and of reality, of the kinds of leaks that we've already seen. The complexity of revoking, key revocation rotation and all of those kinds of issues. So there's conflicts there that occur. And I think a large part of it is let's have the nerds in the room go solve this. They just don't want to. That's an attitude.
So what they need is some sort of technical briefing paper that from somebody they trust that explains it in terms of
matter.
They can digest.
Wait, come on. Have you watched the news lately? When do facts matter from emotions? And that's
or confirmation
bias. That's the
bias.
Other part.
Yeah.
Well, I feel it, so it must be true. And that's the other part of this, which is, you know, look, I've got a lot of friends in law enforcement. I mean, I'm still a paramedic, and I just got my recertification last week. I know what it's like to, you know, have to give the family bad news about their loved ones. I've had friends. I know what it's like to investigate cases. I've been out there when I was doing mountain rescue work in Boulder. There were times we would be asked to help with evidence searches in in particular terrain that was, you know, not easy for the average person to go through, and because we have search experience. So I get it. There is an emotional response of, I could stop this crime. I could catch this bad guy. You know, this is my job. That's what I'm supposed to do. And there's a tool just sitting right there, and Apple's not going to give me access to it, because that's how they look at it. And I've seen that in like law enforcement forums. That's how they post it. So that's hard to get around, because, you know, you see the things that they see, and I have seen those things. You deal with those kinds of cases. And then the ones that I don't see, but I know about, or I know people who have investigated them, some of the worst of the worst. And of course, they're going to want access to every tool that they can get their hands on to lock these people up. And they're not thinking of the larger consequences, such as, well, if I have this backdoor, then China has this backdoor. And then now iPhones cannot be used for business, because if I go over to China, they're going to image my phone when I'm not looking. Because they've done that. They've done that on older devices, and they have done that on laptops. And I know this because I work at the highest levels of enterprise security. I've gone to China, and I could, you know, take me half an hour to go through all the security that I went through personally when I bring my devices over there, including using throwaway devices, which is has been considered the standard for executives for a while now.
Yeah, that's where you leave all your information at home, and you travel with a simplified phone that has nothing on it, and then you access your information remotely in the cloud when you're traveling, right?
Yeah, and even then, under restrictive situations, and then I don't ever lose physical sight of my devices, because they'll come into your room when you're out at a meeting and image your device or install malware on it.
I just saw that the other night on NCIS, where put a little device next to a phone and cloned it. Is it? Can you do that to an iPhone that's properly configured and Bluetooth is off?
Well, you can on TV, but no. That remote acquisition kind of stuff you see in the TV shows, yeah. Those are the kinds of things that cause us problems, because that's not realistic. There are other techniques that are usable, but not even on iPhones. Like, I'm at low risk for them to go after my iDevice, because they would have to use a zero-day, attack. Although I guess there's these new devices out, and we don't know exactly how they're imaging the devices yet.
Oh yeah, that gray box, right?
Yeah, really curious as to what they're doing there.
That's an evolving story. Yeah, we're learning more and more.
Yeah. So if but again, these things happen, and so if there's a golden master key, that's going to make it easy for all these foreign governments to do what they want. Think about the implications for democracy when all of a sudden, there's. Any government, democratic or oppressive, has access to every online service and all of your devices. That means that, you know, there is no longer a concept of free speech at that point. So that's, that gets into the political side of this, but you can't, I don't see any way that we can have it and they can't, when we're talking about global companies. And we're already seeing that happen in China, as Apple has been forced to hand over their data centers to Chinese-owned companies, right. And that is so the government can gain access.
Right. Well, it's been a very interesting discussion. I'm glad you filled us in about all of this, and it confirms everything that we've been writing about at Mac Observer, but thank you for the technical color and the background on this. So we're just about out of time. Have you published any articles at Tidbits recently that you want to talk about that I can put in the show notes?
The most recent one I did was on home automation, because that's a hobby of mine. And Josh Centers at Tidbits has just published Take Control of HomeKit and Home Automation.
I had him on the show and we talked about that. Yeah.
Yep. So I wrote an article about that, because that's a hobby. And I have over 100 devices in my home, and I've been doing this for about 12 or 13 years now. Cool. That I've been doing my home automation. So every light switch and some motion sensors and sprinkler system and lights and fans.
That would be a sight to see. That would be amazing.
You almost don't notice it, though. That's the trick, is anybody who walks into my house, it needs to work like a normal house works.
Okay, cool. I'll put that in the show notes. All right. Well, that kind of wraps things up. Thanks for your insights and telling us your career story and giving us all your insights about Mac and iOS security. Thank you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell us how the listeners can contact you if they wish. The best way, Twitter or
Yeah, you can contact me on Twitter at rmogul. And you can also email me at rich@tidbits.com.
Excellent, excellent. All right, folks, you've been listening to Rich Mogul, the senior editor for security at Tidbits. And you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.